What's up, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today is June 7th, 2018, and I have a very special guest today who is not only a very kind-hearted and lovely individual who I love talking to in general, who I just found to be a great person, but also somebody who is a ferocious researcher, somebody I've had the pleasure of making their friendship with over the last couple of years. And that is Christine Richard. For those of you that don't know who Christine Richard is, she runs Orion Research. They do due diligence. They do research for investors, for lawyers, for all different types of foundations. She contributes investigative research to Plainsight, which provides access to millions of legal documents and does deep dive document-driven research. She is a former reporter for Bloomberg. She is an award-winning reporter. She also was credited with bringing the Herbalife idea to Pershing Square, which she will tell us about. She did a significant amount of the research behind the scenes on the Herbalife short thesis. She knows the company better than almost anybody I think I've talked to, probably arguably better than anyone, in terms of doing on-the-ground research. She has put in probably hundreds of hours. She also is the author of Confidence Game, which was a book that she wrote about Bill Ackman's short activism into MBIA around the time of the financial crisis, which is a great read and one of my favorite books to read, actually. And I think that's it. Christine, what's going on? How are you?
All right. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Was that a proper, bio? Did I leave anything out?
No, I think you hit all the high points.
Okay, all right, good. That's what I try to do. I don't mention any of the low points, just hit all the high points. Well, listen, it's awesome to have you on with me. I have a million questions that I want to ask you. I have already asked you probably a million questions over the last couple of years. I just want to start kind of broadly. I guess walk us through how you got the Herbalife idea and how this whole thing came to be, because you were really kind of the spark that lit the fuse, right?
Well, I ended up suggesting the idea to Bill Ackman at Pershing Square. I had been a reporter, and as you mentioned, I had written the book Confidence Game after covering the credit markets for a very long time. So I had met Bill through that work. And left Bloomberg in 2011 and went to a firm called the Indigo Group, which was made up of former reporters who did investigative research. And I was given a list of companies to look at and to consider doing a project on. And one of the companies that had come up on the list, you know, people had brought it up numerous times. You know, here's a company that clients think they would, you know, be interesting to see some research on, or lawyers have mentioned this company. So I thought, well, this seems like low-hanging fruit, and let's start with Herbalife. Let's start by taking a really close look at the company.
Yeah, so how did you go from there to just walk me through the progression? What was the chronology of events as it happened? I mean, tell me about looking into it for the first time, what your thoughts were. Talk to me about, you know, how you brought the idea to Pershing Square. Was it well received? Was it not well received? Just walk me through it.
Well, you know, I think one of the things when you first look at the company, you know, that you can look at their financial statements and you can look at their presence online. That's sort of the easiest way to start. And I thought, both, you know, when I looked at them online, there was something I thought was quite striking, in that they were running a campaign called Why Herbalife, Why Now? And this was, had probably this little video had been put together, you know, shortly. I would say, you know, toward the end of into the financial crisis.
Yeah, it was like right around that time. I remember that video.
Yeah, people were losing their houses. They were losing their jobs. There was a lot of fear out there. And so I remember looking at this video. It was called Why Herbalife, Why Now? And it, you know, I had thought of Herbalife as a company that was sort of in the, you know, get rich quick, you know, sell the supplements. It had a sort of, you know, people would say, oh, is that that pyramid company? Are they still around? You know, I didn't have a great idea about it, but I had a sense that it was get rich quick. And certainly when you went on the internet, you could see these Chairman's Club members. This is the top level of their marketing plan. They all had little videos. Here I am on the beach in Hawaii. Here I am with my yacht. Here I am, you know, in my mansion. And, you know, my life, I went from having nothing to having all this. And so I was really surprised to see the Why Herbalife, Why Now, and to see the company not just doing the get-rich-quick thing, but really saying to people, if you're nervous about the economy, if you're nervous about losing your job, if you feel like, you know, you don't have good benefits, you know, Why Herbalife, Why Now? I thought it was outrageous.
Yeah, that video was like excruciatingly odious. I remember watching it for the first time, and you're right, they literally were like, why Herbalife, why now? It's the one guy's like, it's recession proof, you know, like, yeah, at the worst possible time when already pretty much the banks were fucking the middle class completely with the housing crisis, and people that didn't understand what was happening to their money were just watching it disappear. Here these guys are saying, oh, it's recession proof, you know, like that had to be particularly offensive.
Yeah. So, I mean, I, you know, and then when we took around the idea to various investors, you know, I think they're asking the same question, right? Like, why Herbalife? Why now? You know, we all know this is a scam. And that was what people would say to me. You know, I remember one guy saying to me, look, these MLM companies, for people who are interested in short selling, they're like moths, you know, it's like moths to the flame with this company. People will be are drawn to it over and over again, and they get burned every time. So why are you bringing this company to us now? And I felt that maybe it was this, the company had gotten huge. It was over 5 billion market cap. So a big hedge fund could think about it. It had the liquidity to short the company. And I felt it had also overstepped, you know, it was now really trying to present itself as exactly what it wasn't, which was a stable job opportunity. So it seemed like really like fair game. Let's take a look at it now, you know, because it seemed like if you could find a smart person who would take it apart, look at the pyramid issue, you know, which was basically a math puzzle. How, you know, really like how much of the company's commissions are coming from recruiting? Is there some way to take it apart and to really say, yeah, this is a pyramid scheme. And furthermore, it's a New York Stock Exchange publicly traded company.
Yeah, did you take the idea to anybody else? Did you ever talk to like Loeb or Einhorn or any of the guys that were involved with it?
The company I work for has a policy of not discussing investors. Obviously, Pershing became very public in its position, but we certainly took it to a bunch of different people, and the response, everybody was interested, you know, and interested to see some research done on it, because there actually was someone who had done some research a few years previously, Barry Menkow, who was a convicted felon turned fraud investigator, and he wound up back in jail again related to some research to do with another company. But he was all over the MLM companies for a while, and then he just kind of disappeared from the scene. And I think later it was Herb Greenberg that wrote a story saying Herbalife had actually paid him $300,000 or $400,000, yeah, to just stop publishing.
Yeah.
So I think people felt like, you know, there's good stuff out there and they're interested to see it. But I do remember people would say over and over again, you know, what's the catalyst here? I mean, do you really think the government's going to go after them now? And why would this happen? And, you know, Bill Ackman's just a different kind of person. He said, if this is a fraud, if we can make a good case for it, we'll be the catalyst. You know, we'll go out there and and we'll say it's a fraud. So that's how they wound up with it. They were willing to be the catalyst.
Yeah, just to go back on Minkow real quick, I think they paid him something like $300,000. The interesting thing about Minkow was, you know, aside from the guy's past, obviously he's a convicted felon and then he wound up back in jail. But separating that from the arguments that he made, one of the things that he brought up often that I think may have been something that really resonated with the company. I don't know. Obviously, I can't prove this, but he was like zoned in focus on this issue of the lead content in the company's shakes. And he, I think more than once, had brought up that, you know, there were dangerous levels, or he had thought there were dangerous levels of lead in the company's shakes. And then subsequent to that, there were a number of scholarly journal articles that were published, including one or two in, I forget what they're called, but hepatology scholarly journals, essentially reports that did studies with Herbalife products and found, went and examined cases of hepatotoxicity, which is essentially when your liver, hepatotoxicity is toxicity of the liver, essentially. They were examining cases of hepatotoxicity as it related to the lead products, the lead in the products. And then at one point, you know, a couple years back, there was that woman, Lorena Peralta, who died in Mexico. And I heard some interesting stories about that. There were a bunch of stuff that I don't even want to get into because it's all kind of rumors and innuendo. But there were talks when she died about her being addicted to the product, quote unquote, addicted to the product. There was like an original report that the Mexican media released, I think probably before the company got to them and had it pulled. But the original report, I think, quoted a friend of hers or somebody that said she was addicted to the product and she supposedly died from some type of liver toxicity. And that's what Minkow was touching on. So did you ever look into that issue? I mean, that never came up publicly with Ackman.
You know, never looked too much, you know, into doing things like having the product tested and whatever. But I do, I read a number of the reports. And what always struck me, you know, these supplements, I don't think it's just Herbalife. I think there are other supplements and it, right. You know, the manufacturing process may be good. It may not. Herbalife has tried to take more of it in-house, you know, to, I think, address that kind of issue. But it strikes me that one of the problems is to sell supplements in an MLM kind of format. You get a lot of people who are in a position of needing to buy a lot of product to participate in the MLM opportunity. You know, there's always the inventory loading pressure. I don't care how the system has been changed. There is always pressure for people to buy more than they reasonably need. And so I think you have people that start to live off of these products. And I know I've talked to people in Colombia and places where trying to climb the marketing plan, you know, you get the whole family consuming the product because you're using so much of the family's monthly budget, food budget, to go toward buying product that people are just probably taking too much product. So I think that might explain why it comes up again and again. You know, you're just stuffing yourself with supplements.
Right, and taking way more than you should be taking, probably, right?
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen those cases distributors will have. They'll kind of shake it, you know, like make this rattling noise at conventions and things. And they must have, you know, 30 different pills in those things.
Oh, yeah, it's insane. There is a video I saw. I'm not sure where I saw it, but I saw a video of people. The theme of the video was, you know, use the products, live with the products, whatever. And they had these massive, like, fishing tackle boxes full of fucking, like, supplements and pills and people, you know, forcing people. Yeah. There was one woman I saw at a convention, like, chugging, like, the aloe concentrate or some shit. I was like, oh, my God. Like, that can't be good for you, just stuffing all that shit in your body. And part of, I'm sure it's not company philosophy now that all these big quote-unquote changes have been made, but certainly there was a running theme in the Herbalife underground that, you know, it was take all of the products every single day, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely being a product of the product. And you needed to, if you needed to buy whatever, 2,500 volume points to get to a level where you qualified for commissions, or you were going to be able to sit VIP at the training event and let everybody know that, hey, I'm successful, I'm moving a lot of product. But if you're not, and this is in your house, like people will say, you know, it doesn't wind up in people's garages because it's a consumable product. You know, it's a meal replacement largely.
Speaking of being a product of the product, that was one thing that Madeleine Albright said in her taped interview with Michael Johnson. You know, for people that don't know, Madeleine Albright was brought on as a brand ambassador for Herbalife, which means the company cut her consulting company or whatever they are, whatever the company is she used to advocate for things and lobby for things, cut them a check. And there was a video of then Herbalife CEO sitting across from Madeleine Albright saying to her, Madeleine, you're a product of the product, aren't you? And she's like, yes, I'm a product of the product. And it's like, you know, she doesn't take this shit, right? Like, I don't know. Well, reminded me of that.
Yeah, I mean, this is their expert at this, right? Getting people to transfer their credibility to the company. The company is just constantly seeking people to sort of leech off of their credibility. And I think we saw the ultimate play out of that move by Herbalife in its relationship with Carl Icahn. I mean, he's a person who said he doesn't like the products, right? And yet I think he's made pretty clear in the last as he's started to leave the or exit his position that, you know, look, he came in and helped the company out in a tough situation. And I think it's interesting. I think the ultimate credibility play was them getting a billionaire many times over to come in and back them through what was a 5-year questioning of the company's credibility.
Yeah, and the crazy thing about Icahn, I mean, the thing that I still struggle with is, look, you want to come in and be a billionaire, you don't like Bill Ackman, that's fine. And you want to come in and squeeze him out of the trade, that's fine. I mean, that's the financial markets, that's how it works. If you have the money to throw around and cause a short squeeze, then you do. And if you want to lend your name to a company, then that's what you do. I mean, that's what activist investors do. But, you know, everybody, not just Icahn, Bill Ackman, all these guys, that, you know, that's their playbook. The astonishing thing for me with Icahn was he never really seemed to fucking understand anything at all about the company. I mean, from one of his first interviews where he refers to the stock ticker as HALF, you know, he says, do I think HALF could be the mother of all short squeezes, which for those of you that don't know, isn't even the stock symbol, number one, to the fact that he, you know, said publicly, oh, it employs a lot of Spanish people. Like, it doesn't employ people. The company is actually fighting to distance itself from its distributors so as to not create liability for itself. And this guy's on TV saying, oh, they're employees. And then on top of that, he goes on CNBC 6 months ago or a year ago, says, you know, I tried the product. Personally, I don't like it. It gives me gas, you know? So, like, he doesn't like the product. He doesn't understand how the model works. And he doesn't know the stock symbol off the top of his head. And here's your white knight in shining armor. And sure as shit, the guy came in and, you know, made $550 million profit on the trade. It's insane. The whole thing with Carl is insane.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it is a shame. I know Scott Wapner has written a book on this, and he was going to be on your show, and I'm sure the book is an you know, interesting Wall Street story about how that all happened. And I think it is important that people realize it was always a bigger story than that. But it's amazing how the press and how everyone in the end chose to focus on the battle of the, you know, the Titans, the right. Wall Street battle. Yeah. And that's, you know, certainly for me, a disappointing way for it to be ending, because,
well,
a sense that, you know, there's a sort of a winner and a loser, and these it's a, you know, about the billionaires, and it really isn't. It's a issue that affects, you know, so many people in America and around the world. I mean, this is a major export of the United States, is to export this idea of MLMs, of, you know, the American dream, taking this small, you know, starting out with a small direct selling company and making something of yourself. It really deserves scrutiny somewhere other than Wall Street, I think. I hope that is,
well, it's,
is ongoing.
It's indicative of nobody doing any type of real deep dive research, okay? Because it's impossible to do a deep dive, at least in my opinion, it's impossible to do a deep dive on this company and come to the conclusion that they are an ethical national treasure, as, you know, Bill Stieritz and John Hempton all call them. But even Scott's book, I mean, you know, I wasn't going to address the book because he's not on the podcast, but even his book, he doesn't, you know, I read the book. Have you read it or no?
I did do an interview with Scott, but I haven't read it yet.
Okay.
Just can't bring myself yet to read about the, I feel like I've lived through the battle of the billionaires and someday I'll read it. I'm sure it's good.
With all due respect, to Scott, you're not going to learn anything from the book. There were two kind of little scoops that the book had. They released kind of both of them on CNBC.com already as teasers. You know, the thing about the dossier, and then there's the whole Michael Johnson and Church thing, whatever. There's some real stories there, by the way, that Scott did not get, digging into the personal lives of these people, none of which I'm going to share because I have a baseline level of courtesy and respect for fellow human beings. But there are some personal life stories in there that he could have touched on that he didn't. However, I will say this, you know, the end of the book is called The Coda, Big Thoughts. It's supposed to be his big decision as to whether or not, you know, whether he agrees with which side. I mean, the book pretty much details the process of how everything happened. And all of the citations are all of the articles that I'm sure you have read. And throughout it tries to tell things from different angles, but it doesn't really draw a conclusion. And even at the end, he says something to the effect of, you know, the company has put its swashbuckling days behind it, but I don't really know whether or not, you know, I don't really know whether or not it's truly a scam. You know, we'll have to wait and see. And it's like, no, we don't. You know, the FTC came out and already made that decision for us. We don't have to wait and see anything. Go read the FTC complaint. So that type of dancing around this, not just by him, but by other people that were involved. And admittedly, I guess his angle is he wanted to focus on the Carl versus Bill story and not the Herbalife story. But that's why this thing has been allowed to gestate for 30 years and has become the behemoth that it is.
Yeah, no, it is very hard to get people to focus on MLM, definitely. And so it was very easy to focus on the money involved in arguing over it. But I still don't, in a way, it's almost like arguing about religion, you know, if people just get very upset about it. And, you know, especially this question of, is it a pyramid scheme? You know, it seems in some ways almost impossible to define what a pyramid scheme is. And I think the basic issue here is that there are a number of companies, hundreds, if you know, hundreds of them in the United States that are deceiving people and basically stealing their money. And telling the same sort of stories about, you know, financial freedom. One I see increasingly, and it is just awful, you know, is the marketing toward stay-at-home moms, stay-at-home dads too, I'm sure, but focuses so much on women and making them feel guilty. Like, you know, you what are you doing working? You could be home with your kids. And the deceptive, you know, presentation I see from, I look mostly at Herbalife distributors, but I see it other places too. I mean, you know, it's not, it's more harmful than get rich quick. It's saying, you know, you feel under stress, you need to work, your children need you at home, why not take up this job? And then people wind up in debt, more financially stressed. Like, I don't know, I think I that's a problem. How long do we let people make money off of other people's stressful situations like that?
It's insane, is really what it is. And if you don't think the victims are real, you know, there's obviously there's a great video that Pershing Square put together that details some of the victim stories. If you don't want to watch that because you know Pershing Square had a you could say they had a conflict of interest or was biased at the time. When I went to the Betting on Zero premiere, I stood in line with the guy Zach Kirby, I think his name is, who was featured in the movie.
Oh, right.
I met him outside the theater, and he was telling me about his story because I didn't know what was going to be in the movie. I had only talked to Ted Braun a couple of times, and you know, I didn't really know that this guy was even going to play a role. And he just told me his whole story about how he went and he opened up a nutrition club. And, you know, eventually he had the wherewithal to understand that it was, that it was a scam. He said, you know, at one point, I finally figured it out and I wasn't going to dupe other people into this. So he switched and went to open a vape shop. And then there was the other guy, the guy who had his own construction business in the movie, that wound up losing tens of thousands or whatever it was. The victims are very real and they're out there, and there's just, it's astonishing to me. Let me ask you a question. Here's a question for you, Christine. What do you say to somebody who says to you that you haven't done enough on the ground due diligence? You haven't talked to enough distributors. This is another criticism, right? That people that are long the company like to lob at short sellers. Like, you're just grossly misinformed. You haven't talked to enough people. You haven't visited enough nutrition clubs. Tell me about what you've done.
Yeah, no, I mean, I really don't know if anybody in the history of time has ever spent, you know, four years full time looking at a single MLM company. So it's, yeah, it stuns me when people say that, but they do say that. I've been to dozens and dozens of clubs, had researchers go to clubs all over the world. I mean, once the issue of the company being shorted became more public, it was harder for me to go because people might recognize me. But
right.
Have done, you know, hundreds of interviews with former distributors. And, you know, people do that. They get upset, like, oh, look at Pershing is pushing forward these people who have been harmed by the company. And, you know, they see something really horrible in this. And I would say that it is so difficult to get people to come forward and talk about their experience being burned by a pyramid scheme. That, you know, it really was, being able to hear these interviews with people, it's really unique. I mean, you couldn't have gone on the internet before and found people who talked about their experience with losing a bunch of money to a pyramid scheme. I mean, I would find most people would say, even if they would agree to talk, even if they would say, I did lose money, a very small fraction of them would say, maybe I'll talk to you about it, but I certainly don't want to talk to anybody in the government. I don't want to talk to anybody in the press. So to sit there and be in a video, that represented going through, you know, so many people who had been harmed by this. And those videos focused, I think a lot of the people had come into Herbalife and got involved in this lead gen business, which the company then said, we're getting out of this in 2013, and basically banned their distributors from selling leads and buying leads. But I certainly talked to many people, especially a lot of retirees who lost $100,000 plus of their retirement savings because they saw some ad that said, you can work from home, you can, you know, You can replace your job. You can, you know, bolster your retirement security. And there's never been, I mean, Herbalife has never been held accountable for that. And they will say, oh, well, we got out of that. They got out of it at least 10 years after they got into it. And 10 years, you know, they were being sued in 2003, 2004, when the company was coming public again. And they bear, you know, it was a big part of the business for 10 years. And there's been none of those retirees have been compensated for losing their retirement.
One of the other things that really fascinates me too, and I don't know how much you looked into this, but one of the like particularly annoying things and really disgraceful and awful, I think, parts of this whole mess about Herbalife is this was dealt with and adjudicated in 1986 in California, where the company is headquartered. And for those that don't know, in 1986, there was a permanent injunction placed on the company in the state of California, which is their headquarters where they operate, that prevented them from doing many of the things, or it was supposed to enjoin them or prevent them, or I don't know what the legal term is, but it was essentially told them that they were not to make false health claims and a bunch of different transgressions that they had made back in the 80s. This was, I guess, signed into law or made effective in 1986. I would encourage you to read the whole thing. Go on the internet, look up Herbalife and the 1986 California Permanent Injunction. There's a couple really good articles written about it. But that essentially gave Kamala Harris, who was, to the best of my understanding, it gave her, who was the attorney general at the time of this whole mess going down, the ability to step in and stop the company. At any second, she could have stepped in and said, you're in violation of this permanent injunction, but she didn't. And so I found that to really be nasty, the fact that, you know, and now she's, I guess she's won a Senate seat. But I also thought that would be a good segue. Tell me about, you know, did you look at the 86 injunction? And how does the company keep the government from cracking down on it in cases like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole MLM industry has been incredibly successful at keeping the government at bay. I don't know what else to say about it.
Oh, they definitely have.
Yeah, when I started looking at the company, I do remember thinking, you know, I had previously written the book on MBIA, which was a municipal bond insurance company. And, you know, it was very clear that this company had a lot of influence in every municipality. It turned everyone's debt into a AAA rated security. You know, you figure a lot of people have that company's back. But I couldn't quite imagine that MLM companies would have as much support in Washington as they do. That was, you know, certainly a miscalculation on my part that they, of course they would, you know, because they have known since they were created that there was this regulatory threat that they were always going to have to deal with, that they were always going to be called out as pyramid schemes, and people would argue that they mislead consumers. So they were prepared. I mean, this was just another like, okay, here we go again.
Right.
I remember when I first went to see Herbalife, I went with an investor to their investor day out in Los Angeles, and all of the investors, there was a few analysts, maybe six of us that stayed to see a president's team, kind of a rally ahead of the day they give out the awards for the Mark Hughes bonus, you know, the big commission payments. And it had become obvious to Herbalife that I was there with someone who was sort of a well-known short seller. And they just went absolutely into, defensive mode, Michael Johnson got on the stage, and there were thousands of people in this auditorium, all this music, you know, huge pictures of Mark Hughes. It was just it was stunning to see how they would whip up the frenzy among the distributors by just showing Mark Hughes's picture, or even showing this spinning kind of pinwheel on the screen every time they wanted people to applaud. It was just bizarre. And at one point, Michael Johnson is, you know, he's talking about how things have never been better. They're going to hit so many billions in retail sales. And he looks across that room, and I could swear right at me, because he knows where this small group of analysts is sitting. And he said directly to me, you know, we know the critics are out there. We know they're there, but that's okay. You're going to make us stronger. And it was boom. And then he was on, the pinwheel was spinning again, and he was on. But I feel like they wait for that moment. You know, they know that criticism could come at any time, and they're prepared for it.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like Scientology, you know, they attack instead of just playing defense. And I've said on other podcasts, and I'll admit again, I think the company, in terms of what they could do from a spin perspective and what they could do from a public relations perspective to combat this, and a lobbying perspective, I mean, they look, when you don't necessarily have the truth on your side, and you're going up against somebody with the veracity of a Bill Ackman, you really need to hit everything 100%. And I think they did for what they could do to defend themselves, just in terms of bringing on people like Alan Hoffman and, you know, Pamela Jones Harbor, whatever the hell her name is. You know, of course, we've never heard from her again. You know, just bringing on people like that to just say, all right, well, they're our ally. And, you know, hiring Saad Verbinnen or Joelle Frank, I forget who they hired, but some, you know, incredible PR firm that did a good job for them. And putting a spin on things like they did the morning of the FTC announcement, where the FTC dropped a complaint that basically in every term aside from pyramid scheme imaginable described them as a pyramid scheme. And somehow they got the Wall Street Journal to run. Somehow they got the Wall Street Journal to run the lead that the FTC declared that they were not a pyramid scheme, which was not what happened, of course. But that wasn't addressed until, you know, the news conference several hours later. And by that point, it was too late. I mean, I think they did a masterful job of PR.
Yeah, and I mean, to say, to leak to the Wall Street Journal, it's official, we're not a pyramid scheme. I don't really understand how they got away with doing that. I really don't. And it's fine, you know, it's fine for now because the stock has gone up. But if the stock does go down someday, I think people will be asking, why were we so consistently misled about the importance of the FTC investigating this company, imposing this really harsh set of conditions to say, look, you know, either you operate legitimately or you're going out of business. And I think there's that the hope has always been they would bide time until Bill Ackman would be driven out of the trade by Carl Icahn, by the stock being squeezed higher. And I have talked to people who have said to me, even early on, the distributors who said, we've been told, just clean this up for now and we'll be able to go back to the way we used to do things soon. And I've heard that again regarding the FTC consent order. Things are going to be, you know, look, we've got to make some changes with nutrition clubs. You can't count other distributors consuming in your club as actual like retail sales, which is what people were doing. But don't worry, we're going to get some people into the FTC soon so that won't matter. So I think that's always been the strategy. Bide our time. Make things look good, and later we can go back to doing things how we do them.
Yeah, it's really crazy. It's I forgot if you answered, but did you ever look at the 86 injunction, the 86 permanent injunction?
I guess I was always aware that It was there, you know, and it was something it seemed clear that they weren't complying with. And I suppose that should have been a big warning sign that you know, just because the government does crack down doesn't mean that companies comply
or that the government's going to follow through. Right. Exactly. I mean, to me, I thought that was like particularly the most offensive thing because it had already been dealt with. You know, so what is the point of putting a permanent injunction like that in place if nobody's going to enforce it? And then, of course, we find out later Kamala Harris is running for Senate and she's married to a partner at Venable, which is a law firm that Herbalife had previously retained. It just doesn't end.
Yeah. And now, I mean, I think we really had a chance when the FTC came out in July 2016 and said, this is, look, we're not going to put you out of business. We're not even going to call you a pyramid scheme. You know, we promised not to do that, which seemed very clear from when Edith Ramirez, you know, took questions, held a press conference to discuss the consent order. She really, you know, couldn't call them a pyramid scheme.
Right.
That was very clear. But she said, you know, they're not a pyramid scheme. So Herbalife was told, you know, if you can prove that you have genuine retail sales, you can keep running your business. If you can't, you're probably going to go out of business. And I think the feeling was that this would be a template for the industry, and this companies weren't just going to be put out of business, because clearly that would be could really backfire on the government, having so many people who have been told for years, you got to put in your time, you got to do your 3, 5, 10 years of losing money before you make money, and then the government shuts the company down. Like, I could see how that would be very hard, but it really seemed like we were going to have these companies just simply prove that they had a legitimate business model. And I think ever since you know, President Trump was elected, people have said, don't worry about it. We'll be rid of this regulation soon enough, you know, and there have been proposals to basically, you know, allow as long as you can have your consumers do all your distributors do all your purchasing and consuming under some of these rules, you know, as long as they buy and consume, you know, they can be drawn into these schemes.
Have you personally kept up with the progress of the, you know, post FTC era for the company? So have you been watching, you know, what the company has been required to do and whether or not Affiliated Monitors, who is the company that is tasked with making sure that they comply with the order, have you tried to get their reports? Because at this point, I mean, have you looked at some of the terminology changes the company has made? Have you looked at, tell me about your thoughts on the company post FTC sanction. Have you looked at it at all?
Yeah, definitely. Continued to look and have sent numerous things to the FTC and to the outside monitor of Affiliated Monitors, which is being paid to make sure that Herbalife is complying with its very complex set of rules now regarding how they can pay commissions and who they can pay commissions to and how people have to document their sales. And what's been really disappointing is the Affiliated Monitors, I think, will be doing a report every 6 months. The first one was done sometime in November, and that report is not being made public.
So the public, even though the government sanctioned the company to comply with these rules and they're a public company, the public, not just the investing public, but the public does not have access to the outside auditor's report as to whether or not the company is or is not complying with the FTC order.
Right. So we don't know in what areas they might still be deceiving, you know, using deceptive language about or disclosures regarding income or whether there are ways that people are getting around documenting sales. I just don't see, I mean, in a sense, the government here could really use the input from the public, I think, to say, tell us, you know, if you see this not working the way it's supposed to, let us know. I mean, I've had a few distributors call me and say, I don't know what to do about this. This is like a violation of the company's rules. And for some reason, the way they're doing the business, by following the rules, they're disadvantaged because they see other people getting away with rule violations. And they've said, look, you know, the last person I want to call is Bill Ackman's researcher on this, but I don't know who else to call. So I think it's a shame that this isn't being made a more open process so that the industry, and if the industry could comply with this, why wouldn't they want it open?
Right.
You know, why does it have to be so secretive?
Because according to the company, you know, look, a skeptic, a critic, somebody like myself will look at what they're required to produce and what they're required to do. And I'll tell you, I personally believe there's absolutely no way that they can meet the criteria of what they need to do in North America, and that they would be better off just closing up shop in North America and opening up elsewhere should those rules be enforced. But and the company will tell you that they have no problem. As a matter of fact, I think they already came out and said we hit the 80% threshold at one point, but there was a promotion that had to do with that, and I believe there was some terminology changes. There was some fuckery going on there that allowed them to at one time and through the first, you know, it was at the first, like, whatever it was, a quarterly checkpoint, they made this big announcement, like, hey, we met the 80% threshold. For those that don't know what that is, it's essentially that 80% of sales have to be retail sales and not based, you know, not sales based on recruitment versus, or 80% outside the network, rather. What's the definition of that before I fuck it up? And
yeah, no, it is very complicated. I think for the company overall, I do think they need to show that 80% of their net sales are being documented by their distributors, and if they can do this, they get to continue paying commissions at the full, like, on all
right.
sales. And but then individual distributors are also needing to hit certain thresholds in order to qualify for advancement and to move up the plan. Yeah, I don't feel like we've been getting great information on that. It's sort of like, don't worry, we're in compliance, but they don't really say, I haven't heard where they are in the documented
sales. Well, the company came out. They came out at first, didn't they? And like,
yeah, right
for the first
the bat,
quarter
they
and
were
say,
in
look,
compliance.
We met, right,
yeah.
We're in compliance, we met the 80% threshold, and then nobody's heard anything else from them. And certainly the company isn't voluntarily releasing the affiliated monitors report.
Right. So I think it's a bit, I think there is they're biding time to try to get to a place where there will be really, like, there won't be pressure on them to comply with this. And it's such a shame, because this was going to be, I think, the template for the whole industry.
Yep.
And for trying to, you know, decide how do we rein this thing in, which now I believe it's the Direct Selling Association's own numbers that 1 in 6 family members have someone involved in an MLM. And that's, you know, at any given time. And so I'm sure, you know, not people on Wall Street, they probably almost never are their children approached
right.
about, you know, when they're graduating high school or college and told, hey, I've got this great opportunity for you that might, you know, derail you for 4 years and
right.
and take thousands of dollars from you and leave you feeling like a washed up failure at 24 years old. That doesn't happen to people on Wall Street. So I don't think there is an awareness of how widespread this is. I did a Reddit session yesterday with a group called the Anti-MLM Group. They have 167,000 members. And, you know, these seem to be mostly people who know other people who've been involved in MLMs, family members and friends. And, you know, most of their questions were like, how can I convince them that they're ruining their life, that they're destroying their finances, that they're pushing away their friends, you know, and their family.
Yeah, it's a difficult conversation to have.
Way. Yeah, because it's not people. I think Robert Fitzpatrick, who has been studied pyramid schemes for decades, after he got involved with one and then really just made it a lifetime mission to take them apart. I know once he told me, you know, the thing about that makes this fraud so so horrible is MLMs really tamper with people's souls. And I think that's such an accurate description. I mean, I've been to places in Oklahoma where, you know, not only is this a part of, you know, obviously it becomes your career. So it's all tied up with your finances. Your whole social network is involved in it, and you push out people who aren't involved in it or discourage you from being in it. It's also, you'll see it in churches increasingly. These kind of prosperity churches will have members that really actively promote MLM to church members because it's such a perfect fit with this idea that, you know, some opportunity is going to come along. If you stay open to it, God will, you know, will provide this opportunity, and you just have to keep believing. And it's horrible, you know, to see people's entire lives just taken over by this, by what is a fraud,
right?
You know,
and you're right. It doesn't happen to people, you know. It doesn't happen to the children of those who work on Wall Street. And as my buddy Matt Stewart would say, you know, he says, look, I drive through Short Hills, New Jersey, which is a very affluent area. He's like, I don't see any nutrition clubs in Short Hills, New Jersey. You know, why is that? Why are the people that are already driving around in Lexuses and Land Rovers and Jaguars, how come there's no nutrition clubs in that area? Yet, you know, in my neighborhood, when I was living in Germantown, Olney, there were two nutrition clubs within probably 3 or 4 miles from my apartment. Or, you know, even if I moved down to certain parts of South Philly, there's a, you know, a nutrition club here or there. Certainly, even as you go a little bit further south from, because of course I went and did some on the ground research in Philly as well. There was one right on Germantown Ave for a while. It turned over twice over the course of 18 months. I think it was two separate nutrition clubs. I think it had two separate owners, and then eventually, this is all within 18 months, and then eventually turned into a sandwich shop. And that's what it was when I left the Germantown area. And then there was another club further down on Shelton Ave in Germantown. There was one going a little bit further south on Broad Street, all in low-income areas, you know, very ethnically diverse areas, you know, often in areas where there's a large Latino population, you know. And so you just, like, Matt, why is Matt Stewart not seeing any nutrition clubs in Short Hills, New Jersey by the Short Hills Mall? Yet I can walk out my front door in Germantown or, you know, in North Philly and point to two of them. I mean, that's not a mistake, right?
Yeah, no, the first place that I went to look on the ground, sort of research to look at nutrition clubs was Corona in Queens. And you know, I could see there was like a club that had enough of a presence. It had something on the internet, and there was this kind of central club. And then I went in and talked to them, and it was very empty, but not completely, you know, and people would be kind of coming and going, and I would be introduced to them and sort of, okay, they would have a shake. And so then I started to just, after I left, I walked around maybe 5 blocks in each direction and just kind of worked my way out. And, you know, a couple of hours, I was able to find 26 of them within, you know, just a sort of like 10-block area. So it's amazing how people will, you know, once it takes hold among a group of people or in a community, it's almost as if the growth, instead of putting people off, like, oh, you know, why would I want to get in this business?
Right.
There's too many
people already
in it.
Becomes a self-fulfilling
prophecy. Yeah. It's like, look at how popular this is. So yeah, it tends to be that way. The clubs are very concentrated.
Yeah, and one of the astonishing things about the nutrition clubs was that, you know, I learned from actually the first time I met you, which was at the nutrition club presentation that Pershing Square did in New York City, was the way that these things functioned. I always knew that there was something weird about them. Obviously, if you have to have the windows covered, if you're not allowed to say that you're selling things, there were all these little intricate rules, and you can go in and somewhere on the internet find yourself a rule list of how to operate a nutrition club. There's all of these rules that are really, really strange that would tell anybody with a little bit of common sense that they're trying to, you know, exercise a couple loopholes here and skirt some rules as, I guess, a retail business or whatever. But you read this big, long, intricate list of all these crazy fucking rules, which just makes it sound weird, you know, like having the windows covered. I mean, that in and of itself is just incredibly weird, right? Why would I need to have the windows covered? I'm running a business, right? Supposedly.
Well, I think the idea is you're running a club. You're not, you know, you're running a social club. So you're not running a retail business. So you're not collecting retail sales, taxes. Okay, that's fine. And it's very clear you're not a franchise, which would subject the company to different regulation, and they would have to provide people getting into the business with a lot more information about the costs and this sort of thing. I think those things were done so that the business could fit through some loopholes. But I think now it's become a really important part of their business. It has been more and more important, though you don't hear about it as much. From what I see, the really successful distributors, an awful lot of them are running nutrition clubs, and they're looking more and more like sort of shake shops with menus, and clearly items are for sale.
Right.
And so I think that does create a problem at some point, you know, or can people make this, I mean, a lot of them can't make it work financially anyway, and that's before they wind up paying taxes. I think that complicates it. And
for those that don't understand what Club 100 was, whatever you want to use, just give a listener right now that doesn't understand anything about Herbalife Nutrition Clubs, give them a quick overview of how Club 100 works and what it is, because this was really one of the craziest fucking things I had ever heard. The crazy thing too is Bill kind of promoted this nutrition club event as it was going to be the coup d'etat, which I kind of thought that it was. It just wasn't presented in a very sensationalistic manner at all. But give a listener an idea of kind of how these nutrition clubs worked.
You know, for example, when I went to the clubs in Queens, I went with I went back with people from Wall Street, and we, you know, these were investors thinking about, you know, like, sure, let's see what these things actually look like. And I remember going to one with an investor, and it was, tucked up on the second floor, up this creaky flight of stairs. You go into this tiny little room. And it was packed, and it was just packed with all these chairs around the wall, everybody just sitting there in silence. They were mostly Hispanic men drinking the shake. They just looked like they were waiting for a bus or something.
And right, were people dressed in like workout gear and getting up and doing low impact aerobics?
No, not at all. I mean, not at all. These were people who looked like they might have been on their way home from a night shift, maybe working in a restaurant, or on their way to like a delivery job, something like that. Work boots. So they didn't seem to me like people who would have a lot of time to just sit and drink an Herbalife shake in a nutrition club. And so I remember talking to the investor about this. I said, what do you think is going on?
And he's like, what the fuck are these people doing here? Right.
I have no idea. And I said, do you think they really are here to drink Formula One shakes? And he said, no, but I have no idea what they're doing. And as we looked into it more over the years, you know, you find out there's this whole program that people have to go to if they want to open their own nutrition club. So, you know, it's just a whole big check sheet that could just keep you occupied for the rest of your life. You know, you're expected to come in every day to your local club and consume. At some point, you're going to have an internship in the club, and you're going to work for free, you know, serving the shakes, and you're going to, you know, you're going to drink the shakes yourself, and then you're going to go to weekly trainings, and you're going to go to monthly trainings, and you're going to drink a shake there. And you're going to, part of the internship, you're going to be in the club, and you're going to have to invite 100 people to come into the club and actually drink a shake. So you're going to have to convince people to come in, maybe family, maybe friends, maybe try to give out free shakes on the street. So I think that's what those people were doing. They were undergoing a training program, and we sort of started to refer to it as conscripted consumption. Like, you needed to consume in these clubs if it was your intention someday to open a club. And it was a very appealing idea, because the way that these clubs were talked about, I mean, this was really your way into the upper middle class. So, you know, you were going to make a couple $100,000 a year, $500,000 a year, be set for the rest of your life. That's what you were going to do.
So what you're saying is, if I wanted to open a nutrition club, I wanted to start my own Herbalife nutrition club, that I would be required through this Club 100 to go to other local clubs to consume the product on a regular basis. And I saw one of these checklists. I don't know if it was several times a day or if it was once a day, but you're required to go. And this was the checklist for Club 100, which was technically not an Herbalife sponsored club. You can talk about that in a second, but you were required to drink the shakes. You were required to stop into your local club. You were required to consume, I mean, tens and hundreds of shakes and tens and hundreds of the aloe tea products over and over and over again. So they were using you as a consumer if you wanted to open your own club. And then what you're saying, if I'm correct, is that you were also required to recruit also before you could even open your own club. So,
yeah, I mean, there were all kinds of variations on it, but and I think people could get, you know, you can get away with more with certain people than you can with others. And some people are more aggressive about how they might enforce this. But yeah, I mean, basically, it was this, it's ingenious, really, to have people start to look like consumers in clubs, but it is part of a requirement that you do this in order to, you know, to be allowed to run a club. Yeah, it was. And I remember after we gave the presentation, Herbalife CFO John DeSimone was the person who responded to the presentation. And, you know, it was very dismissive. Like, this is ridiculous. It's a great program. We're going to tweak it just a little bit, and then we're going to, like, make it official. Well, that was 4 years ago, and I've never heard them mention that program. I don't know if you have. I think variations on it still go on. In the United States, I've seen a newly branded one that looks very similar. Of course, across Latin America, Mexico, this idea that you join a group, you're part of this big group that trains together, that supports each other, so that when I'm sort of starting out thinking about opening my nutrition club, it's really important that I support people who've been in the business for a few years. So that's why I'm visiting their club to see how it works. And by the way, to support them in the way that people will support me when I'm finally got my club open. So it's basically a money transfer scheme.
So in order, you know, in addition to enticing people with a business opportunity in order to move product outside of nutrition clubs, right? In addition to enticing people with, oh, you can start your own business, you can be an entrepreneur, et cetera, and that getting people to purchase product or, you know, load inventory. If you want to open a nutrition club, it's the same deal. You're pretty much doing the same thing. You're going to have to recruit. You're going to have to go out and I mean, it's like another recruitment scheme inside of a recruitment scheme, right?
Yeah, basically. I mean, and at the same time, it sets up a way for these clubs to look like when I went to the club in Queens and I wondered why everyone was sitting there. Everyone who's sitting there is saying to themselves, well, I'm doing this now and then later I'll open my own business. But hey, I look around and I see, you know, there's 20 of us in here and we've all paid $5 to this guy to, you know, drink a shake in his club. So I can see how this business might make sense. It's really elaborate, and I think it it was developed. It's been developed over the Nutrition Club concept, I guess, the last 15 years, probably now.
It's fascinating, and I think also too, when you add up the amount that people were expected to consume, like you said, at $5 a shake, I think it was. The ingenious thing about the nutrition clubs is they break down the requirements for reaching the supervisor level, which is the level you need to hit in order to have the right to recruit for and earn from recruiting, to receive recruiting rewards, rather. It breaks them down into $5 increments, right? And so instead of ponying up $3,000 to pay for your inventory load to, or, you know, instead of somehow reaching your $3,000 volume point level that you need to become a supervisor in order to receive recruiting rewards, this kind of broke it down into smaller $5 increments, right? And by the time you got to the end of the required purchases to run your own nutrition club, you had ostensibly created the volume points necessary to earn supervisor status. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think the idea with nutrition clubs, which were created in Mexico, was it's almost like the single selling single cigarettes. It's well, this is not a market where we think we're going to be able to sell a lot of canisters of, you know, $45 Formula One, but we can sell these $5 a day shakes. And I mean, I would argue, no, you can't sell $5 a day shakes. But what you can do is you can convince people to part with $5 a day if it is part of a plan for them to someday have their own business.
Right.
Because that's expensive, right? I mean, in Ecuador or in Mexico, in a lot of places, this is that's an expensive purchase. And so I think people they're purchasing more than just the shake. They're participating in something that they're told is going to really change their financial future.
So let me ask you a question. What have you experienced throughout the course? Because you're still doing research on Herbalife. I mean, you just published a report with Aaron Greenwald, I believe his name is, from Plainsight.
Greenspan, yeah.
Aaron Greenspan, rather. That is an astonishing report. It's I would encourage everybody to go to Plainsight, Plainsite. That website has a copy of the report, basically talks about Herbalife and money laundering for the most part, but it's an extremely well-researched and well-sourced report that everybody should take a look at. But my question is, you're still kind of going here. You've been going at this for, you know, 4 or 5 years. You've disclosed that you were on Pershing Square's payroll. Now that they're out of the trade, what does that relationship look like between you and them? Are you still working for them? Are you doing this research on your own? And then I have a follow-up question from there.
Okay. Yeah. So no, Pershing, is out of the trade as far as I know. And I'm not working for them to provide, them with research. This report that, Aaron and I did, we had done, some work as part of the Pershing project to look at, you know, all kinds of issues would come up. And this question of money laundering was one that was just perennial. You know, like it people would mention it all the time. And, you know, is it true? Is it not true? So we went and dug up all the legal documents, all the articles, everything we could find, at interviews, just to say what is the sort of public history of this. And we do look at a few instances where the company's distributors were involved in money laundering for drug cartels. And you can read the cases; they're all on Plainsight. And then, you know, what we looked also just at how the company has structured itself given this this history, and really to understand it, you know, you got to realize Herbalife is a very global company. They're in 90 plus countries around the world. They have so they're basically a giant shipping company. You know, they're moving product all over the world, and they're a payments company. I mean, they've got people who might be distributors in Mexico who might have business in, you know, who have recruited people in the United States, or Portugal or Russia. It's always incredibly complicated, and people can get paid, you know, on all these different markets. They get paid in U.S. dollars. So it's just, it's a very complicated company, and it's the way it's structured is very complicated. So one of the things that has always been perplexing about it is people will tell you, well, distributors export a lot of products around the world, which it doesn't make sense because the company will ship these products for you, right?
Explain what that means to somebody that doesn't know the company.
Well, so I mean, if you're a distributor in the U.S. and you happen to recruit some family members in Mexico and they buy product, you know, you don't have to ship it to them, you know, and Herbalife will take care of that, right? If you go to Mongolia and you can recruit some people, they will ship the product to them, and they will get you commissions based on that and pay you in U.S. dollars. But again and again, when we would talk to people, there was this issue of distributors taking possession of large amounts of product and shipping them all over the world. And this would be, you know, this would be considered basically sort of gray market shipping. You know, you're taking it out of the company's official distribution channel and you're moving it around yourself. And whether there could be all kinds of reasons for people to do this, but one would be money laundering. I mean, if you're using cash to buy product in one country and you can then ship it and sell it to somebody who runs a nutrition club in another country, you've basically just moved and cleaned money. So it's the fact that Herbalife has allowed its business to be this susceptible to gray market shipping, to be open to gray market shipping. I mean, really, distributors and former employees would say, I don't know why they do it. Maybe people can't get all the products they want in different countries, but it's a huge problem. If you try to call it to management's attention, you'll often be told to leave it alone. So-and-so's in such and such a chairman club member's downline, and so just leave it alone. So we just describe how, you know, what we found in terms of kind of out of control gray market shipping. And then we look at a number of just things that are hard to explain. I mean, the company's business in Venezuela obviously was being used to move money out of Venezuela. Whether it involved drug money or not, who knows? But it very clearly was being used as a way to get dollars out of the country. So just something to consider. If it can be used that way just to get money into a hard currency, it's, I think there's a risk. I think it's impossible to figure out who owns the Mexican warehouses. We had questions about, you know, issues to do with Indonesia, huge export market, never talked about, owned by somebody else. Just a lot of what we identified is just sort of blind spots in the business. Third parties that never get talked about or disclosed that run the business in numerous countries. You never hear about it. Even in the United States, they have a lot of their warehouses are run by another company. So it just seemed like a lot of work that had been done, that people had sort of, you know, discussed a little bit that the issue was out there, that money laundering had been looked at. So we just thought, why not put it out and just say, here's what we know. That's the end of it. That's all we're going to do. But it's the story as it's how we understand the company to work.
It's really strange that you mention the shipping part of that, because it brings me back to Michael Burton. For people that don't know who Michael Burton was, he was one of the most prominent Herbalife distributors. He passed away, right? Is Michael Burton the one that passed away, or no?
No,
or am I mixing
no.
him up with somebody else?
No, that was John Peterson, who was a very
John Peterson, right?
Founders Club member.
So
yeah.
Michael Burton, some years back, I think in 2013, who was a president's team member, right? Michael Burton filed for bankruptcy, and on his bankruptcy schedule, which I pulled up while you were making that last point, on his bankruptcy schedule, on his list of creditors holding unsecured non-priority claims. This was entered into some docket in, looks like, July of 2013. He owes Federal Express $196,110. And there's a couple shippers on here. There's Federal Express. DHL is listed on this list. And I'm just going to check real quick to see if UPS is. Yeah. Oh, Jesus Christmas. He owed UPS $405,000. Okay, so this is a guy who has $500,000 in that he owes to shippers. That's $500,000 worth of shipping that he owes between UPS and FedEx, not counting any other shippers that are on this list that I didn't notice. That is so strange because UPS and FedEx are not in the business of extending credit. You know, they're not out there letting you run up a $500,000 tab. You know, for more than probably 90 days. So suffice it to say, it's probably reasonable to assume that he was doing a significant amount of shipping business pretty routinely, right? I mean, does this say anything to you?
Yeah, I mean, that's the heard about it over and over again. And it makes, you know, I don't know, well, maybe there are explanations for it, but it, you know, is the shipping too Herbalife shipping too expensive? Are there products that people want they can't get? But it came up so many times that it just seemed worth highlighting. Right? Why is he must be shipping around product? We'll assume why. I mean, the Herbalife, this is for distributors. This is one of the things Herbalife provides, right? They provide a certain amount of like global marketing, and then they'll pay your downline commissions and they'll move your product around the world. And I think it, no matter what's driving it, it certainly raises questions about, you know, customs and tax evasion when you've got your distributors moving products and possibly something more. But it's never been anything that it's been cracked down on.
Just think about what you have to do to rack up $500,000 in shipping charges.
Well, and the company has a process, as I understand it, of when they open a new market, they really let their top distributors open the market, which is different from how they describe it, which is a very controlled process, you know, and they, figure out, okay, we want to be in here. We get all the approvals. We get everything set with the government. And then we go in and boom, from day one, it like sets off the frenzy. Even they'll talk about a pop and drop, right? It's the new game in town. Everybody wants to get in on it. But again and again, I mean, what we were told is the top distributors in this company, they get in early, going back way back into the 80s and 90s. They get in early. They recruit their own downline. They import their own product. They set up events. They basically assume a lot of the company's costs for them so that the company doesn't really have to make a move into the market until they know whether it's working or not. But they don't disclose this to their investors, that they sort of allow this sort of rogue element to expansion. And I think the problem that creates is you have these distributors who go in, set something up, perhaps get financing from who knows who to open a market, begin shipping, begin, you know, paying for things in cash. Who is that? I mean, it's outside of Herbalife's control, but it sounds like if somebody's wildly successful at it, the last thing Herbalife wants to do, you know, is shut them down.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And when you look at a document like this bankruptcy schedule that I'm looking at now, I mean, it just becomes clear that, you know, I don't know. Look, this guy listed $7.1 million in liabilities and $74,000 in assets, right? What's going on? What, this guy's on the president's team? What's going on? What's happening? Anyways, look, I don't want to hold you for too long. I just had a couple other questions, and then we'll keep it moving.
Sure.
But are you doing all right on time?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, I know that you said to me when we started.
I know, half an hour.
Let's
right?
hold it to a half hour. I was like, there's no fucking way that's happening. You know, yeah, Christine, of course, you were so sweet about it. You're like, well, I don't want people to get bored. I'm like, look, people can turn this thing off whenever the fuck they want. They don't, if they're done listening, they can be done listening now. But look, I want to know, right. I want to know throughout the course of your research, what was really the most, what was the most astonishing thing that you discovered that really wasn't brought out to the media's attention, that wasn't that, you know, maybe that's something that Bill didn't address. What really stuck with you? What's something that people don't know from watching the news on this story?
It's so, you know, it's so difficult, I think, to isolate it to one thing. You know, it is kind of like peeling back the layers of an onion. You know, people say, oh, now they're looking at that. Now they're looking at this. It's like, yeah, that just sort of seems how it is, right? When you start looking at a company like this that has built a business on defrauding people, it's not surprising that they draw people who do things that, you know, best made just to read about it in the report, but that the company is then used for money laundering. So I don't know. I mean, maybe I think some of the things that happened with Venezuela are really, you know, it's still somewhat of a mystery to me, but I can tell that when the company started to, you know, when it first came under scrutiny in late 2012 and then into 2013, I just felt like they shut down a lot of the lead gen, the defrauding of people, you know, using these television ads, you know, replace your job, quit your job. They cut back on that, and they just found this huge market in Venezuela. And I think, you know, I still have questions. How were they able to sell as much product there as they were? How much of it was just people getting their money out of the country? Did Herbalife finance this whole arbitrage where people could pay in bolivars and get paid in dollars at a favorable rate? Did they tap into Kadivi money? I think it's important. It would be very important to understand that. I think it really helped to save the perception of the company that, you know, when they started to clean things up, that the U.S. Volume didn't just fall off a cliff. They replaced it with volume in Venezuela.
Right. And for people that don't know, the bolivar is Venezuela's currency. And Venezuela has been experiencing ridiculous hyperinflation where the value of the bolivar has dropped significantly versus the dollar. And I don't know the exchange rate off the top of my head, but it has lost something like 99% of its value, the currency, which means when it, you know, if you used to be able to get 10 bolivars to the dollar, now it's something like, you know, 50,000 bolivars to the dollar. And those aren't the exact numbers, but it's something like that. And what you're saying is that people may have been using the company as a function to get out of the bolivar because sales are recorded locally in local currencies, but commission checks are always paid in U.S. dollars. Is that what you're saying?
And there were conditions that needed to be orchestrated from the corporate level where the price in Venezuela was held down, you know, not reflecting inflation. People were paid at a favorable rate in U.S. dollars. And we have in the report, we do have a document that shows internally Herbalife knew all of the growth in Venezuela was due to basically a currency arbitrage. They didn't disclose this to their investors. They said people are really, you know, gravitating toward the nutrition club model. We've got some great new products. They didn't say we're essentially letting people use our company to move money.
And meanwhile, at the same time, they were reporting to their investors. I believe they were taking the negative effects of the hyperinflation in Venezuela and the loss of value because the value was lost somewhere in there, and they were adding that back to their earnings. They were Xing out the loss from Venezuela. Essentially writing it off and then presenting their earnings in a non-GAAP fashion with that kind of added back in as to say, look, here's what our earnings would have been had we not had this huge problem in Venezuela. So I'm accurate, right, in saying that, to the best of your knowledge?
I think it did. It did make the results look very, very good until it sort of had to be acknowledged that they wouldn't be getting this money out at
right.
any kind of reasonable exchange rate. And I think there are so many things there that aren't clear. I mean, I would look at trade data and you could see that there were products that would be sent to Ecuador that would never clear customs, and possibly they made their way to Venezuela, but they would be mislabeled as medicine, milk, specialty, pharmaceuticals. So I don't know if they took advantage somehow of the fact that certain goods did get a government, the government would provide, the central bank would provide very scarce, increasingly scarce dollars for these if it was an essential product. And I think you could argue Herbalife wasn't. But again, if people start moving stuff around through the gray market, if you've got top distributors moving things, just through their own shell companies or whatever, this kind of thing is possible. And you could see that in their distributor ranks, the people who were shooting to the chairman's club, so many of them were from Venezuela. As the country was collapsing, Herbalife was adding more and more Venezuelan chairman's club members. And I don't think we ever got a very good explanation for how that works. So I think that is maybe my major frustration in never being able to fully understand
right.
that, because I think some very odd things went on there that shareholders haven't really been fully informed about.
Well, and there's a lot of these unanswered questions, a lot of things that I can't even begin to speculate on whether or not, what may have happened. But like you're talking about this sudden kind of burst in Venezuela out of nowhere at the time where a country's collapsing. And this always brings me back to when they changed all the rules in Mexico and it didn't seem to affect the business at all. And look, I think maybe at some point down the road, I don't know, maybe we'll get some answers to some of these things. The thing is, the company is so intricate and it is so complex that it's, I don't know. I'm hopeful that we get answers to things like this as to why they happen, but I'm not especially confident because, but certainly you looking at things like trade data, customs data, you've been there, you've done these you've probably done a deeper dive on this than almost anybody. So it's definitely.
Well, so now this report that we've put out, I think it does leave, it's very lengthy. So you've got to wade through it. But I mean, I think if people are interested in putting some of the questions to the company, there's some interesting questions to ask in there. I mean, one of the things I looked at was, they recently they have a credit facility that they have been borrowing against to buy back their shares and to buy Carl Icahn out of his shares. And they back that debt with more than 2,000 trademarks all around the world. 19 of them are on a company called Life and Victory, which was a known money laundering company. So again, maybe just I don't think my questions would be answered, but if people want to put them to the company, there's, I think, some stuff in there that is worth seeking an answer to.
So going forward, what's your plan? Are you going to stay on this? What should people pay attention to going forward? What should I look at going forward with the company? And what are your plans going forward from here?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it'll be important to see if the Federal Trade Commission does follow through on really, really imposing the conditions and the consent order. So I plan to watch that a bit. I can't let it go quite. It's just been a long road, and I would like to know the answer if they're complying or not. I am curious. I think their business in China is important to look at, and there's a lot of confusing signals coming out of China in terms of You know, are they being looked at as potentially as a pyramid scheme, which you can see local articles saying that, or is the government giving them multi-million dollar grants so that they can spread their business across right. China? It just doesn't really make any sense. I think looking at the outcome for the, there's a lawsuit in Florida, Rogers versus a number of the top Herbalife distributors and the company. And it looks at the events system, which hasn't gotten much attention, but is really, I think, crucial to getting the most, the people who are most damaged by this, who spend the most time and money, they are, it's the event system that is used to really, to keep them spending. And I think it'll, I think we should know in probably a few weeks. I believe at this point, we're waiting to see if the judge decides whether the case can go forward or if the plaintiffs need to go to take their grievance to arbitration. But there were a lot of issues raised in that complaint that if it goes forward, maybe we'll get some answers to how these top distributors are, how are they really making their money? You know, they get up on stage, they run all these events. Are all of them really just making their money from selling Herbalife products, even recruiting distributors, or is there more to it? I mean, that lawsuit raises some interesting questions too.
Yeah, I read the complaint. It's fascinating. I think you're right that procedurally right now they are, there's a bit of a traffic jam with a bunch of motions trying to, like you said, go to arbitration, change jurisdiction, all these other things. But I read the complaint, and discovery in a case like that, should it proceed, I think would be fascinating. I think discovery would be fascinating. If I could ask for one thing and get it, that would be what I would ask for. I would ask for there to be discovery in that case. I think that would be, I think we would get a lot of answers that we don't necessarily know.
Yeah, no, I think Jason Jones, the lawyer who put that complaint together, is, you know, it has spent years and years studying online scams, just scams generally. And, you know, he really went into it knowing, you know, I think knowing the company extraordinarily well.
Oh, he knows. Yeah, he knows the company very comprehensively, much, much better than I do, because he knows all of these intricate little, he knows where to look. And so that's why discovery would be kind of interesting going forward. All right. Well, listen, I would encourage people that are listening to go check out your AMA on Reddit. The subreddit was anti-MLM. It's fascinating. I read through some of it today. I can't believe you produced so many answers in such a short amount of time. Did they transcribe that or do you type it?
No, I type it.
Oh, my God. Yeah, because there was an awful lot there. So you must be a very good typist.
But, former reporter, so I can type, yeah.
Right. Yeah, there and everything was punctuated great. It's well enough for me to say, like, was it transcribed? But I would encourage people to check that out and definitely to check out your the report that you did on Plainsight as well. And listen, I just want to thank you so much for coming on and talking to me. And I hope that going forward, we can have you back on anytime there's a development and we can talk about it.
Yeah, great.
You have anything else? Any other concluding thoughts? Anything I missed?
No, I better leave it there.
No shout outs. All right. All right, Christine, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. And we'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you.
All right. That was Christine Richard. Herbalife researcher extraordinaire and absolutely phenomenally talented investigative reporter and investigative journalist. She has gone about as deep as anybody can go on Herbalife, which is why I always kind of find it funny that sometimes she's accosted online on Twitter and stuff like that. People say, oh, you didn't do the work. You didn't go to enough clubs. You didn't go to enough countries. It's like, look, she fucking went in, okay? When she tells you she has interviewed hundreds of victims. She's interviewed hundreds of victims. She has gone to the nutrition club. She has gone out of the country. I mean, the work that she has done has been so comprehensive. And really the fact that, you know, she's not working for Pershing Square anymore and she's still kind of dug into this should give you an indication as to the veracity of her research. So Look, I've said many times in the past that I think there are a bunch of things under the surface here that we don't quite know about yet. I think Christine has kind of put her finger on the pulse of some of those things. And I hope that either her or, you know, somebody else has the motivation to go out and dig a lot deeper and maybe get into some of those things where we might be able to get some answers that I think we desperately need. But for now, this was the QTR podcast. I have no sponsors today. I am beholden to nobody. So the only thing that I have left to say is I will talk to you soon. Peace.